Okay, Havana Docks Corporation versus Royal Caribbean. Mr. Clement.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Paul Clement for the non-Carnival appellants. There are obviously a lot of issues floating around in this case, and I'd like to start, if I may, with an issue that's actually dispositive for the three cruise lines that I represent, which is the 2004 issue or the time-limited nature of the concession. The one thing that seems clear to me under the Helms-Burton Act is that you have to traffic in the very property that was confiscated. And so it seems to me obvious that when you're talking about the physical meets and bounds of the property, simply trafficking in neighbor's property or in the subdivision wouldn't get it done. You'd have to be within the meets and bounds of what was actually confiscated by the Cuban government. We would submit that the same thing that applies to spatial limitations applies to temporal limitations.
Let me ask you to address on that issue. The one sticking point I have with your theory is that the statute specifically protects future and contingent interest in property. I'm having a difficult time figuring out how your theory would protect those. What do you say about that?
So I think it would definitely protect those, and I think you can imagine we had a hypothetical in the brief about some stacked leases. And suppose in this situation there were this 44-year concession, and then some other company had a 50-year concession, and all of that was confiscated back in 1960.
Yeah, that's not a contingent interest, though. I mean, think of a contingent interest. So, for example, I have a farm in Cuba in 1945, and I say, look, I'm going to give that farm to somebody as long as that person, keeps it in good condition and intends to use it in farming and whatnot, then they can have it. But if they violate those contingencies, it reverts to me. And then Castro comes and takes the property. How does that contingent interest protect it under your theory?
So I think under circumstances like that, you might have some, questions that you'd have to resolve about like impossibility of the condition and that sort of thing. But just to be responsive to the general statutory term, like an obvious contingent interest is the reversionary interest after somebody's life estate.
Yeah.
And that would be protected, and somebody would have a Helms-Burton Act during their life, but after they died, the person who had the contingent interest would then be the one that has the Helms-Burton Act claim under Title III. And one thing that I think is very important to understand, and just keep in mind, I'm sure you understand it.
But duration, the temporal limit matters in that the life has expired and that the contingent interest then comes into play.
Exactly.
And those are all temporal, though. I mean, I guess I'm just thinking of contingencies that aren't temporal. Here your argument sort of fits because there's this temporal thing, the time, you can envision the time continuing to run even though Castro controls Cuba and everything has changed. But think of all the other kinds of contingencies you would have. I think your theory is that the only way you could sue under the Helms-Burton Act to protect a contingent interest is if the interest actually became a present live interest, right?
I think the circumstances would say that at that point it becomes live such that somebody can traffic in what was confiscated. Now, there may be, from the contingent interest case, there may be an opportunity for somebody to come into court and say, there's an impossibility doctrine here that means that under Cuban law, I can still bring this claim now, but we just don't have that here. And one of the other things that the definition of property specifically addresses that I think makes the point that we have to be right about these kind of temporal limitations is the patents. Patents are something that are specifically protected by Helms-Burton Act. Patents are time limited. I don't think it's rational to say that somehow the confiscation extends the period of the patent past 17 years. So during the period that there was a valid property interest that was confiscated, you could traffic on the confiscated property. But after that, after the patent expires, after the concession expires, you're just not going to have the coincidence of the trafficking and the confiscated property right. And I do think it's important to recognize that it's not like if you don't have a Helms-Burton Act because the concession's expired or something else, that means you lose your ability to get compensation in the claim settlement process that will eventually happen in bilateral negotiations with the Cuban government. And if you think about the Helms-Burton Act more generally, It doesn't purport to be a perfect fit for every person that has a property interest vis-a-vis the Cuban government. It provides a supplemental sort of way to get just compensation for those that have a property interest that somebody that still exists, that somebody can, or that still is contemporaneous with what was confiscated. Obviously, none of these property rights still exist, and this court made us that point in the Glenn case. They've been confiscated, but you still have to have trafficking in that which was confiscated. And in a time-limited system, just like with a spatially limited property interest, if somebody's sort of in the same place but at the wrong time, or in the same vicinity but not the right property, that's just not trafficking in the confiscated property, which is necessary for there to be liability. Now,
your essential point, I think, is that the trafficking has to be in the property and not the claim on the property.
I think that's another way of putting it, but I just think it's clear as a bell from the statute that you have to have trafficking in the confiscated property. So it has to be what was confiscated that you're doing the trafficking in. And what was confiscated here was a concession that expired by its own terms in 2004. There are allegations as to the cruise line that my friend represents, that they were there before that period expired. We don't have any problem with the idea that if somebody got there in 2003, there would be a Helms-Burton Act claim, but 2016, 2017, it's just too late for those purposes. And as I say, there's a lot of other issues floating around this case, the lawful travel exception. We don't really think district court's in a position to do that de novo. The better rule would be to essentially not have liability where there's a lawful travel defense, unless you've had an OFAC determination. But I don't know that you have to decide that today. It's a difficult issue, to be sure. And so I also want to be, before I sit down, I would like to say just a minute on the damages. Obviously, if I'm right about the temporal issue, you don't get to damages, and I very much hope that I'm right about the temporal issue. But if you do get to damages, I do think that the one satisfaction rule should apply in this kind of situation. I think this court has recognized through the prior Helms-Burton Act cases that it's had that there is a real potential under the statute for outsized damages awards, because even if you just sort of step on the property for a day or lend a car to an Uber driver for a day, there's the possibility that you could have the entirety of, in a fee simple case, you could have the entire value of the property awarded. And
I understand that argument, but the one that I'm having a little conceptual difficulty with is the argument that whatever the proper measure of damages is, you can't impose that measure of damages against different entities that commit the same type of violation on the confiscated property, assuming you had that trafficking. So you have a piece of property, to put it in physical terms, and four different parties during the course of the same year trespass on the property. It's the same invasion, but there are four different invasions. I presume you could get damages from all of those parties if you prove your trespass claim, right? It's not a collective judgment once against one of them and then all the others are let go.
Well, I would say that you could get damages from all of them, but you couldn't get 100% of your damages from all of them. That is the one satisfaction.
But it depends how you define your damages, right? Because if you think that a physical trespass under whatever applicable law is worth X, then every time somebody commits a separate trespass, you can get X. And so you may have four times X, even though the nature of the violation was the same, but you had it happen four times. I don't understand this collective problem that you allude to. I understand the other issues, but not that one.
Okay, let me, if I may, try to be responsive to it, because I think that it is the default rule. And here, I don't think, you know, trafficking just on the property or trespassing on the property is actually not the damage that is actually being remedied by the remedy under this statute. And I think if you take a step back, it's worth keeping in mind that it is actually not a violation of Cuban law, U.S. law, or international law for the Cuban government to take this property. It is a violation of all those laws for them to take the property without providing just compensation. And that is built right into the Helms-Burton Act. The definition of confiscated property is property that is taken or nationalized without providing just compensation. And so once you get just compensation as the damages remedy under the Helms-Burton Act, the original sin essentially has been remedied, and it is just that one violation. So if you get it against four people.
I will say, I think that damages rationale makes a lot of sense to me. But it seems to undermine your liability theory, and this is the way, to me at least. If we're trying to compensate for the taking of property, and that's it. So these people have a claim for X amount of money because their property was taken. We're not looking at trespass. We're not really. They don't have the current property rights. How is it that the lease keeps running? You know, how is it that the lease has a time on it? Because they're now suing on back to a claim, really, against the Cuban government, and they're just pulling you into it. It seems like there's an inconsistency there.
I don't think there ultimately is. Obviously, if you think there is, go with my liability argument and ignore everything I've said about damages. Here's why I don't think there is a disconnect, though, because you are trying to provide, ultimately, the just compensation that the Cuban government should have given in the first place.
Right.
But they don't provide that remedy for every single person on the planet. I mean, this court has a case that's, I mean, maybe it's an anomaly of statutory construction, but if you inherit the property in the wrong way, you no longer have a Helms-Burton Act. You still have a claim against the Cuban government. So I think you still have to go back to the fundamental question of who has a Title III claim under the statute. And you could write a statute that says anybody that comes near a property is a potential Helms-Burton defendant. But here they said you got to trespass in the confiscated property. What was confiscated? It was not fee simple. It was a concession that expired in 2004.
I just have one more hypothetical I want you to address. So let's say there's a lease that has a renewal clause and says that there's a right to renew. Same argument that the lease ends. You just look at it, ends in 10 years. Or would you have, I'm just trying to figure out, it seems like your liability theory involves a lot of counterfactuals. And so just, what would you say about that hypothetical?
A lot of counterfactuals that aren't before us.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't think my case involves any counterfactuals.
Right.
And
they're factuals in your case.
They are factuals, yeah. And they are relatively clear. There really isn't a dispute between the FARC parties. Maybe my friend Mr. Landau will tell you otherwise, but I don't think there's a dispute that what was taken was by its terms going to expire in 2004. There was no renewal clause. There were any of those things. I think when you get to renewal clauses and things like that, that's where you might get into this question of, oh, I would have renewed. The only reason I didn't is because of the Cuban government's expropriation. That's an impossibility defense. There probably is something like that under Cuban law. But I'll tell you, I don't know for sure.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Clement.
Thank you.
Mr. Sham again.
Thank you, Chief Judge Pryor. Canon Shammingham of Paul Weiss for Appellant Carnival. May it please the Court. We entirely agree with Mr. Clement's argument regarding the temporal limitation on the concession here. And it is true that Carnival stands in a somewhat different position because there were claims that Carnival had an ownership interest in entities, Air Tours and Costa, that conducted cruises.
But the district court didn't decide it.
The district court didn't decide it. That is correct. But we would respectfully...
We really can't in the first instance, can we?
We would not ask this court to address any of the numerous dispositive legal grounds, including the statute of repose, why that remainder of the claim should not go forward. We would, however, urge the court to address one other issue if it agrees with us on the temporal limitation, and that is the closely related issue concerning the scope of the concessionary interest. And in my limited time, I really want to say two things about that. First, that there was abundant evidence in the record before the district court that this concessionary interest was simply a non-exclusive interest in conducting cargo operations, such that the passenger operations at issue here did not transgress that interest. And of course, in our brief, we point to everything from the proposal for the concessionary interest to Cuba's acceptance of that proposal to the law of ports in Cuba, and in particular, the report of our expert on Cuban law, Amber Diaz.
But isn't the violation here allegedly not just the ferrying of passengers to and fro, but the docking?
Well, Well, that is correct for purposes of passenger operations, and the evidence was undisputed that that was permitted and would not violate the interest even when the interest was in effect. And I would respectfully submit, as we point out in a footnote in our reply brief, that there is no suggestion on the part of Havana Docks that there was some sort of broader fee interest in the terminal and the like. I think at most, my friend Mr. Landau in his brief suggests that this usufruct interest was somewhat different from a lease. We agree with that, but the critical point is that it was an interest that was limited to cargo operations, and it's really a question for my friend Mr. Landau, and I think his brief is rather circumspect about this, exactly how they would define that interest. And I would submit that on this record, they cannot define that interest in a way that would suggest that passenger operations were excluded, such that if a company had wanted to dock during the life of the concession, they would have been transgressing the terms of that concession. And so as a result, the other argument that I want to address in my very limited remaining
does the cargo limitation, to use your words, apply if a cruise line lands at the port and goods are transported on and transported off?
Perhaps
foodstuffs, for example?
Well, there was no suggestion to that effect in this case. We are suggesting that even on this record, no, because again, the concession was non-exclusive. But I think the easiest way to conceive of this is that we're talking about passenger operations, and there's no suggestion that that violates the concessionary interest. Now,
your answer on the movement of foodstuffs to and fro
would be the same. Now,
then, what meaning or significance does the cargo limitation have then?
Well,
it is taking cargo on and off the vessel.
It is literally a concessionary interest. And as Amber Diaz's report indicates, that means two things. First, that Havana Docks, during the life of the concession, had the right to conduct cargo operations. Mm-hmm. And it also had certain authority over the property itself. It had the right to construct various things at the terminal. And those reverted at the end of the concession to the Cuban government. The other point that I wanted to make, though, is that I think that the primary argument that I think you're going to hear from Mr. Landau on this point is the argument concerning the Commission's decision. And our submission on the Commission's decision is, first, that as a statutory matter, that decision, to the extent it addressed the issue of the scope of the right, would not be entitled to deference because the statutory provisions talk about both, first, the fact of ownership, and second, the value. Those are the only things to which the Commission's order gets deference, not any determination of scope. And second, that everything that I have said this morning is in broad terms consistent with the Commission's decision. The Commission's decision recognized that there was a concession, recognized that it was time-limited. There are indications in the Commission's decision that it was thinking about cargo operations. And so there is nothing, in our view, that we are arguing here today that would be inconsistent with that decision, even were it entitled to deference.
Okay. I think we understand, Mr. Chairman.
And I've reserved a minute for rebuttal. Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Landau.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Chris Landau, and I'm here today for the Appellee Havana Docks Corporation. Let me go right to this issue of the alleged expiration of our
Let me ask you
right.
a question.
Absolutely.
Let's say the cruise ships were negotiating with the Cuban government about docking. And the government said, we want you to dock at Havana Docks. And the cruise ship said, that it was once owned by a United States national. We're not sure we're comfortable docking there. And on the other side of the shore are the Jose Marti docks. And the Cuban government says, well, all right, how about you unload your passengers at the Jose Marti docks?
Yeah.
If they had done that, they wouldn't be trafficking in confiscated property, right?
100% correct, Your Honor.
Why is the geographical, though, limit on the confiscated property effective in that context and the temporal not? Because that's your problem. I know what a usufruct is. I went to Tulane. I took civil law property. And this usufruct has a limited life.
Right,
and it expired in 2004. Your own brief says
a
that.
A temporal limitation attaches to the specific property. We have nothing
right.
to...
Right. And it also it attaches, in this case, to a specific time period.
Well, this is the key point, Your Honor. Again, I think what this statute is a little bit funky in terms of normal statute. It's not trafficking in the property that the plaintiff currently has a possessory interest, because by definition, these were confiscated by Castro.
No,
right?
What was confiscated, though, was the usufruct with a 99-year life.
Correct. Well, yeah, that is correct. And I think the key point here, Your Honor, is their whole argument is based on the usufruct with a 99-year life expired. Right? This is the absolutely clear point. They say it expired in 2004. The point is, if the usufruct was extinguished, if it was expropriated before 2004, it didn't expire.
I mean, you've got to know, you've got to define what the property is, though.
Okay? Correct.
You can't value the property. I mean, look, a fee simple interest is going to be more valuable than
correct.
The usufruct would be. A leasehold interest is going to have a different value. And that's affected not only by the geography, it's affected by the temporal limitation, too.
You are 100% correct, Your Honor, but that is still, that is the valuation. It still remains the property which was confiscated. In other words,
you can't confiscate that property, though, after it no longer exists.
Well, it wasn't. You're right about that. You can't confiscate after it no longer exists. But it was confiscated in 1960, right? At the time
right,
it was confiscated,
yeah,
you had 44 years.
And you can't traffic in it after
well,
it no
now
longer
this,
exists.
Okay, but now this goes to the other thing. Did they? You don't have to have the current ownership at the time of trafficking.
So it never expires. It's ad infinitum. If it had expired in 1960.
It never did expire, Your Honor. Again, it's like if you have a can of peanut butter that says this expires in 2026 and you eat that can of peanut butter today. Nobody would say the can of peanut butter expired because it was extinguished before that.
I've tried to make this case as simple as possible on some issues at least. The statute says, and you're right that it's funky in a lot of ways,
yeah.
But the statute says that the trafficking has to be in confiscated property.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Not in the claim.
Correct.
And not in the interest.
You're correct.
Okay. What property was trafficked in 2016-2017?
The property identified by the United States Claims Commission, this is in tab C to our red brief, which is the findings of the decision.
The property
that
is
that property doesn't exist anymore.
No,
if you're right, tell me if this is the, and I understand that results don't often drive statutory interpretation, but they can be illuminating sometimes.
Sure.
If your theory of trafficking is correct, assume that the communist regime in Cuba stays around for the next 100 years.
God forbid, but I take the hypothetical.
In 100 years, if Havana Docks is still around, it can sue for trafficking. And
because
it can sue for trafficking forever.
Because its docks remain the property that was confiscated, and they still have a claim to the property. It's like there may be many limitations on the claim.
They still have a claim to the usufruct?
Your Honor,
see, that's the problem.
Yes, they have
you recognize in the background section of your brief what a usufruct is.
Correct.
Then when I get over to the merits section, you seem to treat the property now as the docks as opposed to the usufruct.
No, the usufruct gave us a right. The property, there's a conclusive presumption under 6083A that what the Claims Commission determined the property to be. The claims,
and that was the usufruct.
Right, it said the usufruct, it also said, we find, this is on page tab C of our brief, page 7, it said the claimant acquired at the same time the real property with all the improvements. We built these piers. These piers didn't exist. We built the piers and the terminal, right? And
but
going
those
back
were, but those were reverting to the Cuban. Had there been no confiscation, all those were reverting back to the
right,
Cuban
but there
government.
Was a confiscation. And going
of
back
course.
Initially, those are our property. If you go back to the initial decree 467 of 1905, it had an indemnity provision that said that if the works are expropriated, the Cuban government will pay the company for the value of the works,
right? In other words, these are the physical docks. Again, the statute is conclusive on this. They might want to talk about cargo. They might want to have all this stuff. The answer to what is the property that's confiscated is right here on page 7 of tab C. But again, going back to, I think this time limitation is critically important. Nothing became unconfiscated in 2004. What was confiscated was terminated. And as this court's decision in Glenn explains, at the point of confiscation, right, nobody in Cuba anymore has an ongoing claim to that property. In other words, the confiscations are effective. They're replaced with a claim. So that's still the property that was confiscated are these physical docks that are...
Then we're just effectively treating it as a fee simple interest.
No, Your Honor. No, because it's
The valuation would be different,
well,
right?
But again, Your Honor, you just have to read the literal language of what the commission certified. In other words,
But what the commission certified is not what the statute requires.
The
statute is trying to figure out, first of all, the commission operated well before Helms-Burton was passed into law.
Absolutely.
So it was not acting, it was not adjudicating with a Helms-Burton mindset.
Correct. Helms-Burton was built on that. Yeah.
Agreed. It was trying to figure out whether or not the Cuban government had expropriated, confiscated, taken the property of certain individuals.
Correct.
And then trying to put a value on that property, on that confiscation, if the confiscation had taken place, right?
Correct.
Which would have effects going forward, not only in the negotiations between the two countries, but maybe in some other international tribunal at a later point or something like that. But the statute requires trafficking in property.
And correct.
The confiscation extinguished that property interest.
The statute requires trafficking in property that was confiscated. The statute would be meaningless if the plaintiff had to have a current interest in that property.
Because by definition, current at the time of current, here's the way I look at it, and maybe I'm just wrong. The way you look at property under the statute, and unfortunately, I've had a couple of Helms-Burton cases already, so.
You might get another.
You look at the property interest this way. What is the property interest had the confiscation not occurred? If the confiscation had not occurred and you have a fee simple interest, that goes forward. And unless you run into the Garcia-Bengochea problem about inheritance, you can continue suing left and right for any future trafficking in that property because it's fee simple. But if my methodology is right, once you figure out what the property interest would have been without confiscation, the usufruct here, the concession, whatever you call it, has an endpoint. It doesn't go on ad infinitum. And if I'm wrong, Havana Docks can sue in 100 years if another cruise line uses that terminal. And it can do so for the next 500 years. If the governmental situation in Cuba remains the same, it'll never end. And that seems to me to really dilute any meaning of property anymore.
I think that the point is, and I want to get back to the point that Judge Brash raised earlier about the future, that the very broad definition of property. But just to go to yours, the property interest here did not become unconfiscated in 2004. What was confiscated in 1960 was confiscated in 1960, okay? At that point, we have a claim to that, right? Then we just fall within
the difference is, right, so in the same way, the docks continue to exist.
Right.
But the confiscated property, because it has a limited life, can evaporate because that it no longer exists.
It could have evaporated.
It's as if the docks just fell into the sea and disappeared.
Your Honor, it could have, but it didn't. In other words, their briefs keep going back to, well, it did expire versus it would have expired. The truth is, it didn't expire. It can't.
The confiscation told the expiration date, in a sense?
Effectively, it's an encumbrance on the claim. In other words,
that tolling continues for the next 500 years.
And that's exactly what Congress wanted. It said they don't want Americans doing business with the enemy in communist Cuba, using confiscated property. Again, And this is the temporal and the spatial are different because I have no business in the spatial, right? But when it's temporal, interests are assessed at the time of confiscation. That's the time at which they crystallize.
That's valued, right? It's valued at the time of confiscation.
Correct, and that's why the whole thing makes sense. And that's why going back to
the violator still has to be trafficking in confiscated.
It does in confiscated property.
And if that property can no longer exist,
they have to traffic in property that was confiscated. I think what takes a while to get your head around is it doesn't have to be, we don't have to have a property interest at the time of trafficking. The property interests are all extinguished.
You're trafficking in a usufruct?
Well, we're trafficking in the docks.
They're trafficking in a 99-year usufruct. That's the property.
No, but they're trafficking in the property, in the real property.
You had agreed with me earlier. And you say it in the background of your brief. The property, the confiscated property,
right,
is a 99-year usufruct.
Right, but we're saying the usufruct.
How can you be trafficking in that after the 99 years?
Because the usufruct, Your Honor, also gives you physical possessory rights in the briefs
for 99 years.
For 99 years. That was what was taken. And so the key point here is you look to the property that was confiscated. The entire Helms-Burton Act builds on the confiscation regime that's set up by the International Claims Commission, right? So, in fact, when 2004 rolled around, nothing expired because that concession, our rights and thoughts, had been dead for 44 years. Yeah. They were replaced, as Glenn said, with a claim.
Isn't the premise, it seems to me, of the defendant's argument is that we have to do a counterfactual and we have to ask what would have happened to the usufruct had it not been taken by Castro?
That is correct.
Had it not been taken by Castro,
correct,
it would have lasted 99
correct
years.
But it was taken by Castro.
That counterfactual applies to the act anyway because it's not property anymore. Government that doesn't recognize private property interests.
Your Honor, the Helms-Burton, all the Libertad Act requires is traffics in property which was confiscated. By definition, it's not saying that you have to have a current interest in the property, right? So the fact that it would have expired in 2004 doesn't make it any less the property that was confiscated because it's still the physical property. And how do you know? You'd be liable to a person who owns the claim to such property. We still have the claim to these docks. That is literally in, that didn't go poof in 2004.
You have a claim to this usufruct?
To the usufruct, which involves, as the commission said,
expired in 2004. You have a claim to that.
You have a certified claim to the confiscation and the value of that confiscation.
Right, but nothing, our claim didn't go poof in 2004. Again, I think the key point is they have to traffic in the property that was confiscated. If you were thinking, yes, it expired, therefore they couldn't have trafficked in property where you no longer had to claim. The point is everybody's property rights were extinguished. That's the lesson of Glenn. Right? So all you look to is do you have a claim to that property?
The district court here was of two minds, right?
Three.
Step one. The district court agreed with the general defense argument that this usufruct had a 99-year lifespan and at the time of the alleged trafficking didn't exist anymore, therefore no trafficking. That was the district court's first stab at it, right?
Right.
Okay. Then on motions for reconsideration, it said, I made a mistake because I made findings. I should have been looking just at the complaint and the allegations of the complaint. But at summary judgment, it's got undisputed facts about the usufruct and its 99-year limit and or span. So
I think what the district court recognized, Your Honor, is the district court went back and read Glenn, and a light bulb went off in the district court, and I certainly hope that I can get that light bulb to come off in Your Honor's minds as well. Because the point is, you don't have to have this interest at the time of trafficking. By definition, everybody's interest has been killed by the time of trafficking. So any time limitation then goes into the claim. Again, that's what makes it, you're trafficking in property that was confiscated, right? Then if you are, you're liable to anybody with a claim.
I understand.
Can I ask you a question about damages? So,
sure.
So just as I think the cruise company's theory of liability versus damages is somewhat inconsistent, I think your theory of liability and damages is somewhat inconsistent too. To follow up on Judge Jordan's question, you know, your theory of damages would be that you could sue forever for unlimited damages, correct?
That's because Congress wanted to deter people from doing business in Cuba. It wanted to deter exactly what the cruise lines did. So Congress gave, that's finding number 11 in 6081.
Absolutely. I mean, they did a lot to deter them. I mean, these people are just, I mean, they didn't take your property, for example, but they're looking at triple damages.
That's why there's a separate confiscation injury that's Cuba.
But I don't know that infinite damages is the way to deter. I mean, here's what I want you to respond to. If I were to agree with you, your theory of liability that the property, when Castro took it, the property ends, but it's replaced by a claim. And then if they traffic in property that was taken, they have to pay your claim, right? Why isn't paying your claim the end of the matter? Once they pay you that claim, they've given you the value of the property at the time it was taken from you. They've tripled the damages. Why isn't that the end of the matter?
It goes back to what is the Article III injury at issue here. Again, we're not claiming that their physical trafficking in what used to be our property is, because that is too amorphous. It's the authorization injury, as this court held in Garcia Bengochea. In other words, they could have come to us and not been traffickers if they've only sought our authorization. So that is a defendant-specific authorization.
But the statute, the way the statute is worded, your damages are not really tied in the normal tort sense of the word. They're not tied to the violation of the trafficking. There's an artificial damages valuation. Because if you had, assume you had a cruise line running a test voyage with a skeleton crew and 12 passenger volunteers, okay? Mm-hmm. That's the only trafficking. They land, they're there for a day, they leave. It's just a test cruise to make sure everything's operating correctly. You get the same damages you got here. It's not based on the market value of what that intrusion is or what your client would have demanded
That's true. But
right, the question is, if the damages are an artificial statutory construct, which Congress created, why are you able to recover more than once on that artificial construct?
Congress, as a legislative body, has wide discretion to choose whatever damage. It could have chosen a flat fee. It could have chosen the amount you paid the Cuban government. It said, we want to do two things. We want to deter and we want to compensate. This court has recognized those dual objectives. So the fact that they chose a damages formula that looks like it goes to the confiscation doesn't change the nature of the underlying injury. The only last point I'd really like to make is their theory about expiration cannot be squared with the broad definition of property under the statute. I urge you to look at that. Future contingent interest, it doesn't make sense. Our definition makes sense that the thing did not expire. The concession would have expired, but it did not expire, and therefore we just became claimants, and this became property to which we have a claim. It's the property that was confiscated.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I understand your argument, Mr.
Thank
Landau.
You.
Mr. Clement, you've saved 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few quick points in rebuttal. First of all, Congress could have written a different statute. It could have used the word tolling. It could have had that concept in there. It knew it was dealing with time-limited property interest like patents. It would be very simple to put a tolling word in there, some phrase that captured that. They could have written a statute that says, if you have a claim to property at the same address, that's good enough. Or I suppose they could have tried to say property in the vicinity, and that would have been an interesting constitutional issue. But they didn't do that. They said you got to traffic in the confiscated property.
What about his argument that it went sort of beyond this 99-year lease, but that there was a reversionary part where the Cuban government promised to pay them for the improvements that they made? What about that?
Well, they also had to give the docks over in good condition. I suppose there could have been a couple of dollars going one way, a couple of dollars going the other way. I don't think that has anything to do with
But that's the counterfactual that you're asking us to engage in, is what would have happened had the Cuban government not seized the property. And if we're going to engage in that counterfactual and see this as a 99-year lease that expired, don't we have to do the whole thing?
No, we don't have to do the whole thing. Okay. And the temporal limit is crystal clear. And the thing that I think going any other route...
Same, like what they would have to do is allege that there's some money we would have gotten back and that was confiscated too. We don't have anything like that.
We don't have anything like that. There was nothing like that in the certified claim. And
it's their burden to say what, define what the confiscated property is, right?
Absolutely. And don't lose sight of the practical problems. Congress didn't write the statute they would need you to have written. And the practical problems are enormous. Think about the situation with the, like 10 years of stacked leases. So it makes perfect sense to say, all right, I know what year it is. I know who I have to get authorization from. And maybe I have to get authorization from the person that owns the reversionary interest, the landlord, in fee simple. But under their view, I have to get consent or authorization from 11 different people. That's not the statute that Congress wrote. The practical problems are enormous. A patent without a limited term that goes on infinitum, eternal life estates.
But wouldn't it just end, though? I guess this goes to the damages point, and this is my last question. I mean, if you agree with them, then yeah, they get unlimited damages forever, and that seems crazy. But if you agree with you on damages, then the damages are capped. At some point, that patent that was taken by Castro, it was valued at a certain price when it was taken by Castro. Once they make that price back, then it's over. Why isn't that the right way to fix this problem, not on the front end, but on the damages end?
That is the right way to think about damages, but that's not, but that doesn't undermine the liability.
It doesn't change who has traffic in the
exactly.
confiscated property.
Exactly. And if they're, 17-year patent term, if somebody,
the
trafficked,
right
if somebody trafficked in the 16th year, they're the right person to provide compensation. But if somebody, like, infringed the patent in its 18th year of life, i.e. in its death, or it's afterlife, at that point, okay. The only person who can provide just compensation is the Cuban government.
Thank you, Mr. Clement.
Thank you,
Mr. Shamagin.
May it please the court, our additional submission is that the court should and indeed must address not just the duration, but the scope of the usufruct. Now, Mr. Landau said that the scope of that usufruct is defined by the commission's decision. What did the commission say? If you take a look at the commission's proposed decision, which is at tab C of Humana Docs' brief at pages 3 and 5, it described the usufruct as, quote, a concession for the construction and operation of wharves and warehouses. And the undisputed evidence before the district court was as follows. First, that the proposal by Humana Docs sought to charge fees for cargo operations. Second, that the decree granting the concession adopted the rates for those cargo operations. And third, the Cuban law confirmed that Havana Docks lacked the power to exclude anyone. And I would point the court to pages 27 to 28 of our opening brief, pages 7 to 8 of our reply brief, and to docket 331 and the attachments, which set all of this out in further detail. And so our submission
thank
is...
Thank you, Mr. Shamagin.
Thank you. We would ask for reversal.
We are adjourned for the week. Thank you.
All right.